Future Past James speaking for Past Past James. This podcast overran by like an hour, so you'll now hear it in two parts. This is part one. If James makes you feel uncomfortable, have a think. He doesn't realise that he's yet to get a few wisdom tooth problems the following week. Have that on him. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to what we've dubbed, and I never refer to in my head, as John and Jim's Excellent Journey. It's a podcast which the aim of it was and is to sort of kind of study almost mostly sort of retro cult American culture is kind of where we were initially. We do step out of that because we are not confined beings. We're not in a zoo. We're not here to be caged by your expectations for you to wander past and see the John and Jim labelled in their cage as retro American cult culture. That's just simply not cricket, as we would say over here. We are here to talk about stuff which interests us. In a sense, the Excellent Journey is not yours, my lovely listener. The Excellent Journey is ours, I guess. And in that sense, it is largely unscripted. It's largely unplanned. And the reason I like doing it like this, because I mean, we both have professions where we do have to plan talks and stuff. So, you know, it's not like we're being lazy here. Being unplanned allows us to sort of have our own excellent journey through a podcast like this, because we don't know where the podcast is really going to go beyond its initial topic. And we hope that you too, listening to this, dear listener, will enjoy that journey as well. So this is me, James McLean. We have over there John Kenneth Muir.
Hello. I said hi, James.
Oh, you just said hello, James. that's fine. Hello, John. Yeah, and I don't know where we were now. I've totally.
Oh no, I messed you up, man.
Fine. That's exactly the part of the preamble, isn't it? It could almost be scripted, although, as I've just said, it's not. So unscripted, scripted. So today we just thought we'd like to talk about Star Trek. And it is it the 67th anniversary this September?
It is the 57th anniversary.
57th, that's what I meant, because the 60th is the 66 to 26. Right. Maths going out there, 57th, thank you. 57th anniversary. And that seemed to be a good excuse to actually talk about the world of Star Trek a little bit. Again, got no plans on this beyond Star Trek. I thought that was just a nice topic point. So have we ever talked about Star Trek before, John, on these sort of things? I don't think we have, have we?
I don't think we have either, unless it ended up on the cutting room floor.
But there has been stuff on the cutting room floor. The last podcast we did had a load of stuff on Picard season 3, which I ditched because it was just too far off topic. But beyond that, I don't think we have. I've never asked this. I mean, I've read your blog, so I kind of know the answers, but do you care about Star Trek?
I care deeply about Star Trek, James.
Why?
You know, I don't want it to be mistaken as some sort of religious fervor, but...
It's never good to follow
a star. That's never a good start, right? But the philosophy of Star Trek... and the ideals of Star Trek to me really represent, you know, the best of who and what we are. And I find that even in the weaker Star Treks, whatever those might be, and of course people differ about that, there's still that philosophy, and you can boil that down to hope for the future. But I mean, it gets to a lot of things like, you know, getting along with people, not in spite of their differences, but because you enjoy their differences. The differences make us strong, things like that. To me, Star Trek has been a part of my life since I was 4 or 5 years old, I suppose. And there's just been sort of nothing else that I think has held up like that. Now, you know, obviously I love Space 1999 and Millennium and the X-Files and they all hold up too and have their own philosophies. But Star Trek in the broader culture, you know, and we see sort of its impact on television, its impact on technology, its impact on science fiction, you know, and really that means the philosophy, even if the philosophy is a response to that. You know, if you look at Blake Seven, and sometimes people call that, you know, the anti-Star Trek. And I love that. But it's like Star Trek is so much central to that conversation. And I would say, you know, having, you know, shared it and continuing to share it with my son, my wife, you know, all these years later, it, you know, it's central to the conversation of my life.
You're not old, but I'm on a similar age level as you. So you'd have been very young when you first saw Star Trek. And the explanation you've just given seems to be the sort of explanation I would expect from any of its cult TV members. It'd be worthy of Will Wheaton himself, this idea of Star Trek being a kind of a positive, engaging world, which respects diversity and the like. But when you first watched it, is that what sung to you? How did you, can you remember what it was like when you first watched it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you're right. As a 4 or 5 year old, the thing that got me about Star Trek was its vibrant colors and the adventure. I mean, you know, I grew up, or sort of came into my consciousness, I guess you'd say, in the early to mid 70s. So, you know, between 74 and 77, I was watching Star Trek reruns, Mission Impossible reruns, The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger, Land That Time Forgot, these worlds of fantasy and science fiction and adventuring and exploration. I feel like all of those things have that quality, this kind of questing, adventurous quality. And you're asking what appealed to the 4 or 5 year old? It was that. It was this idea of the adventure. And Star Trek was even better because you know, it was in syndication at that point and was on every day at, you know, 6 o'clock, and a different story. And of course I hadn't seen them all. You know, I was born in 69. So, you know, shortly after the series had been canceled. So I was watching these all for the first time in syndication in the mid 70s. And, you know, one after the other, just this wealth, this library of adventures and excitement and ideas, and, you know, the thrill of people working together on these adventures, the crew of a ship, you know, which you see in stuff like Jason the Argonauts, which is also, you know, being rerun a lot, and, you know, in the Sinbad movies and things like that. So no, it was the adventure that got me first, for sure.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what it was for me as well. I think colors is quite a big thing. I think certainly back sort of 70s, 80s, of course, color was around in television, but the vibrancy. And as an adult watching those original series episodes, I find one of the most intrinsic and innovative things of the time is the lighting of the Enterprise. There's right. So many, not just the sort of the obvious reds of the banisters on the bridge, but just the purples and the greens that they'll have. They'll light the corridors and the rooms to sort of give them an extra sense of aesthetic quality from the sort of grays of the set. There's something quite magical in that, which they never did again, because obviously ways television techniques of filming and producing science fiction shift and change, the aesthetic changes. But the use of those colors I always thought was quite intoxicating as a young person.
Absolutely. You know, the aliens, the colors and shapes of the aliens, you know, the thing about the Tholians and the colors of the Tholians, or even the Gorn, right? Or Yarnik. Yes, right? So it's, yeah, the color, you know, that's what draws your eye first. And you know, I think I'd count Shatner's acting as the color too. I mean, I am not going to be somebody who says he did too much, or, you know, I don't see him as you know, pop culture tends to have certain impressions of him. To me, Captain Kirk, at 5 years old, he is who I wanted to be when I grew up. He was a Renaissance man, a thoughtful man, cunning, strategic, you know, surrounded by friends, a leader. you know, the pop culture has made it a little different, obviously, you know, that, you know, taking some of sort of more exaggerated qualities, but
yeah,
but he's not really that. You go back and watch those shows and he's not really that. He becomes a little more of that in the third season, which I, you know, most people consider the least successful, and I might agree with that, but I still rather like the third season of the original Star Trek. But it does become a little like some of those more exaggerated qualities come a little more to the forefront, I think, there than they do in the first 2 years.
It is fascinating. I was talking to a friend last night, a colleague. She's a little younger than me, born in the 90s. I hope she wouldn't mind me saying that if she listens to this, because I haven't named who she is anyway, I suppose. But she was saying she's a big Star Trek fan. She was saying how for her, the Chris Pine films, I mean, she's seen all the Star Treks. She's not someone who's just watched the Chris Pine films. She really likes the Kirk in the Chris Pine films. And I was saying, I think it's fascinating that what you're just saying, that the legacy of who Kirk is very different to actually when you watch those original shows. And to some degree, some of the Chris Pine Kirk is almost like an embodiment of the myths and legends of what Kirk is, rather than what Kirk actually was. When you watch it, he's a very serious man. He's a very militant man. He's quite, with his staff and crew, he's, I wouldn't say intolerant, but he's very strict.
Right.
He's not particularly gung-ho. He's not particularly, I don't think, apart from the Corbinite maneuver, he's particularly unpredictable. He's not the maverick that he ends up becoming. And there's that scene in the first of the Pine movies, the Kobayashi Maru scene, which I was talking to my friend last night about. And, you know, him taking Kobayashi Maru, and in that he's very nonchalant and he's got the apple and he's, right. He doesn't really care. The point is he's making is that he doesn't agree with the test. And I was just thinking how the original Kirk's reaction and the way he would do it, he'd do that. I always imagine him doing the Kobayashi Maru extremely seriously, taking it right. And acting it out and then winning it and then letting them work out that the test had been changed later on, because really...
Absolutely. And I'll just say, I like very much the Chris Pine portrayal.
Same here. Yes.
For what it is. I think he's really great. I mean, what we're talking about now is the focus of the material, right?
How the interpretation. Written. Yes.
Like, you know, Pine has the charisma, that kind of jaunty, you know, buckle up buttercup kind of thing, you know, which you see more of Kirk, I would say, that Kirk in some of the movies, like maybe the Search for Spock, you know, the word is no, I am therefore going anyway kind of thing, you know, that sort of Kirk, which we sort of come to later with Shatner, but maybe not in the series. Pine seems to embody that more, and I think he does a great job. I mean, I'm really, really impressed with, make sure I get his name right, Paul Wesley, who's playing Kirk in Strange New Worlds, because he's like doing the work part of Kirk, like the Kirk who's smart, the Kirk who studies, the Kirk who is serious and paying attention to Starfleet rules and regulations. You know, he's a stack of books with legs, which is how Kirk was described by Gary Mitchell in
That Is True. I've
done before. And you know, it's funny to me because I think that performance has maybe been seen as more controversial. I keep seeing like comparisons to how he looks to like Jim Carrey, which is just dumb, stupid. But you know, his performance, I actually think it's really good. I feel like his is the most sort of nuanced, serious Kirk we've gotten. And if you're trying to, you know, create a sort of Kirk paradigm or paragon, it seems like earlier on he would be more serious, the way, you know, we saw him. You know, he's not a captain yet. We know about his crisis on the Farragut, where, you know, he lost a lot of the crew from, and that was in the episode of Obsession, and he blames himself for hesitating, for not shooting at the, you know, vampire cloud, whatever you want to call it, right? And he's this serious young guy, and you know, as he becomes captain, he's still that serious guy. And then you kind of feel like in the later Star Trek movies, some of that sort of jauntiness gets played up a little bit.
Yeah.
Because he sort of has the confidence of experience at that point, maybe. I don't know. But it seems to me, if I were this young actor on Strange New World, I would do exactly what he's doing and play the character for where he is and his age at that point. You know, not playing the cocksure, you know, I have an answer to every situation. I don't like to lose, Kirk.
Absolutely. I would love to, at the end of this podcast, have a chat to you about Strange New Worlds, because I have a feeling we probably sit on two different sides on that show. So this is going to be interesting.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, so I agree with you. Chris Pine, I think, does a great job. And also, as my friend was pointing out, Chris Pine's character is meant to be a Kirk who didn't travel the same path, that he's a little more unpredictable, right. That he's a little more... So he is deliberately different. So it's not about, as you say, trying to compare the two, but it's just like, I still feel that he's built from some of the blocks of the assumptions of what Kirk is rather than what actually Kirk was like. And yeah, I think, again, I mean, maybe this topic's all about Kirk, but Kirk, as you say, when you get into the films, is very different. And I think you're right. They write him differently as his age and experience changes, and maybe as well as a character which isn't so physical, he becomes a little more cerebral, and his tactics in all those films are far more smart and ingenious. And that legacy of Kirk sort of, sometimes I think, almost comes from the films and the TV shows, which he's still smart, but the craftiness of Kirk, I don't think, really comes out until the films. So I've got the TV show. Wasn't a great hit at the time, but obviously I'm not going to go through the history of this. If you listen to this, you know the history of it. As you say, syndication in the 70s gave it a massive uplift. The animated series is often forgotten, sometimes right. Considered not canon. I don't know. I consider it canon personally. I know there's disputes because Roddenberry didn't. But
it canon.
Yep, good. So we're on the same wavelength there. That's good. I found as a kid, I obviously, as I say, the diversity, the cast, I never saw as a kid. You don't really notice right. That nuances that's been embedded in there. And obviously the original series has a lot of systemic 60s cultural and political stuff going on in there, which does date it in a lot of ways. And as my friend last night was saying, she was just saying the 60s, she prefers the Pine one to the 60s because the 60s is just, she said, the show's just crazy, it's batshit crazy, and sometimes it is, and I think some of its charm comes from that.
You know, not to go off into a crazy tangent, but you know, it's I think the word is kinky. The original Star Trek is sort of the kinkiest Star Trek.
She'd like that. I think she'd like that.
You know, it is. You know, the costumes, the beliefs, the interactions. It's just much more overtly, I would say, romantic, erotic, sexual than later Star Treks. I mean, and in a way that makes sense. Obviously, you're not going to do that in a Saturday morning cartoon in 1973. And by the time we get to the Next Generation, oh my God, we're in the conservative 80s, and you know, and like in the very second episode, Captain Picard is looking askance at his crew and saying, "Oh, we'll be a fine crew if we avoid temptation." Yes, heaven forbid we should have any real feelings for each other and be sexually attracted to each other. No, we will not be doing that here. You know, that's you know, a total retrenchment into sort of these, you know, conservative ideals, moving away from what we saw with Star Trek, with just Riker, or oddly enough, Data and Yar, like occasionally, you know, having those moments, but you know, much, you know, just we're not doing that. That kinkiness and eroticism is just really not there. It's just really not there.
But then on the upside, you don't have the idea that Scotty, having knocked his head in an accident that was caused by a woman, now there being a concern that he might have issues or violent tendencies towards women when Kirk right. takes him to a planet which is basically a planet brothel from the way that, well, you know, it's hedonistic right. anyway, that's probably an inappropriate, not brothely, but at the time it had this sort of, yeah.
Right.
There are some things in there which were like,
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I actually, this past summer, I went back and I started watching the original series all over again. And, you know, it is kind of stunning that here is a show that understood exactly what everybody can be. It was smart enough to put Lieutenant Uhura on the bridge, and you watch in the first season, she jumps to that navigation console, takes charge, and she's, you know, they understand, but yet they still have to make, you know, stupid cracks about women. You know, it's like, what is going on here that we have the vision to put the women here, make them competent, number one in the cage, Lieutenant Uhura, all this, but yet then we still have this horrible sort of blasé attitude about it where we make these cracks about them. It's a really weird contradiction to be, to be future oriented enough to know, of course women are going to be, and they're going to be here in positions of power, and they're going to be capable and strong. And then we say things like, you know, it's a massive illogical wavelengths or something, and we call that a woman, you know, and some, I'm paraphrasing badly, but Spock of all people said that in some episode, a massive conflicting input or something. I forget which episode it was, but it was like, oh my gosh, Spock, right? Why would you ever say that? Like, no one should be saying that. It's so overtly a product of the 60s. But, you know, I always say to people who say, I hate this word that we're getting all the time now, it's problematic. Like, why watching Star Trek now is problematic? Well, you know, every work of art arises in a context, you know.
Yeah.
And you have to, if you're going to watch it, understand what the context was and kind of forgive it, to expect something that was made 57 years ago to adhere to what our standards of beliefs are today, you know, is sort of blatantly ridiculous. But by the same token, we can look at it and say, oh my gosh, how much we have grown since then. And how can they have held this one belief, which was so forward-looking, you know, at the same time that they had such a backward belief? Very strange.
Absolutely. And it's something, the problematic thing is something that's very individualized as well, because sometimes something can be so problematic that you can't take the same pleasure out of it anymore. And that doesn't mean that no one else should watch it. It just means that for yourself, that it's just doesn't give you that same thing because you now see things in a different light. But I don't think there's too much of that. I mean, I do find it funny, as you say. I mean, Star Trek fans will always rush to the Kirk scene in Balance of Terror about him saying there should be no bigotry on his bridge. And then by the end of the episode, McCoy and him will have a nice laugh at pointy-eared Spock. And, you know, that's all absolutely fine. And the sort of layers of, as you say, this sort of ideology of the show, which is competing with the understanding and the sort of frameworks of television and humor of the 60s. It's quite in itself, to coin the word, fascinating.
I've heard people describe McCoy and Spock's behavior towards Spock as bullying. And, you know, I have never, you know, I mean, again, I've watched the show since I was 5 years old, whatever. I've never felt that way. To me, I always felt like it was friendly and affectionate, but you watch some of them and say, wow, you know, this, you know, green-blooded Vulcan stuff can be a little strong. But, you know, Spock, the thing about Spock is he always gives as good as he gets, right?
But I mean, you can see their argument to the degree that if you sort of take, if you take the fictional race from him and put in a sort of minority race in his place and then play the same jokes at the end of an episode, it probably wouldn't speak as well. And yes, obviously, you know, race is all contextualized around histories and relationships, and you can't just simply swap one for another. But I think in terms of a workplace, if we think of workplace banter, there's probably the way that they sort of openly nudge Spock and everyone laughs. You can see why nowadays there's a few sort of like, perhaps that is not the way that we'd write it now.
Right.
But again, it's of its time and you can enjoy it for that. And McCoy, I find particularly funny because I have a running thing with my sister where we are absolutely certain that McCoy has no medical skills whatsoever. I mean, I do not believe that anyone gets on board a Federation starship and doesn't understand the physiology, not of an alien race, but an alien race which is actually deeply embedded within their actual Federation of planets. The whole thing that he doesn't understand Vulcan physiology, as he says over and over again, makes me question, is does he really know any physiology at all? And is he just reliant on that hypo spray medical tricorder and Chapel, who does all the surgery and everything, which, given a new show, could be the case? Is he just an absolute grifter?
Well, you know, the thing I think that's so interesting about that is by scaffolding a very in-depth universe around the original series.
Yeah.
And in a sense, a more consistent scaffolded universe where, oh my gosh, yeah, if you look at Strange New Worlds, there were other aliens, you know, aboard the Enterprise. Or go back and look at Enterprise, and there was a Vulcan there. Like, McCoy's behavior makes no sense. So, you know, Vulcan physiology, yes, should be absolutely known. But again, it's sort of a contextual thing because there was no scaffolded universe. And then you look at the show, Spock was the only alien aboard the ship. And you know, they didn't even know Spock's father was the Vulcan ambassador till the second season. I mean, so really, you know, so it's like, if you look at what the original intent of Star Trek was and those shows, without that scaffolded universe, it's like, yeah, we have this sort of stranger in a strange land, Spock, who, you know, who we comment on his alienness, but he who also comments on our alienness to him. And then you have McCoy, who's like, yeah, this, you know, this guy's liver is where his heart should be, or he's got green blood or whatever. It's like, okay, that can be believable in this context, because we even knew there was like a Federation ship of entirely Vulcans. It was destroyed, the Intrepid and the Immunity Syndrome. And so you're wondering, how deep is this integration of, you know, different alien races in Starfleet and such. But the scaffolding around the universe now makes like that a sure. Heck, there were, what was it, Denobulan? Is that Dr. Phlox? There was the Vulcan, T'Pol, 150 years beforehand. You know, there. And so it becomes this much more we are the world kind of place 100 years before Star Trek. And that doesn't make McCoy look any better. Let me just put it that way.
So if we move on a bit, I mean, I think with the films, maybe we should leave that for another day. But really liked what you said there about the sort of very conservative approach to Star Trek, which is born in the late 80s and doesn't really change all the way through that run from the early ones through to the Berman Braga era. That conservatism is very much entrenched in those three shows, four shows, Enterprise as well, to be honest.
Right. So, you know, a lot of people do interpret Enterprise as sort of being the most neoconservative of the bunch. Mm-hmm. And again, it makes perfect sense why, if you look at historical context, right? Yeah. That it started airing like right before 9/11, I believe. And then 9/11 happened, you know, psychic shockwave, not just through the United States, but throughout the world, you know, and like any work of art, Enterprise came to reflect its time and its values, right? So, you know, we went from the very conservative 80s, the Reagan era, you know, then into the 90s. And, you know, I always say Deep Space Nine is like the balkanized Star Trek. It's the idea of like, you know, empires breaking down and forming, you know, it's like all of these different points of view. And then we're right back to the sort of monolithic point of view with Enterprise and certainly things like Nemesis. I mean, if you look at the obsession with weapons of mass destruction in the hands of asymmetric antagonists, so to speak, you know, dominating latter-day Star Trek, it's like it's not hard to see where they come from. And to be clear, I'm not putting a character, when I say neoconservative, if you're a conservative, great. I'm not applying a standard to that belief. I'm just saying it's clear that Star Trek was mirroring its context at that
point. Yeah, no, I think that's entirely fair. It's not a comment on any political spectrum there. Right. There is a sort of conservatism to it, which is interesting for a show which is ethos is, in theory, inherently liberal. And again, I sometimes wonder how much of the history of Gene Roddenberry has been mythologized into a man who was purely, you know, looking to try and put the ideals of the future, this utopia, into the show, when there's a lot of stuff in there. And, you know, Gene Roddenberry was also a businessman as well. And
right.
I sometimes wonder about how much, you know, of a balance there is there, and especially... But yeah, anyway, I always wonder how much, especially by the third season when he'd kind of moved on, and then after looking back, how much was revisioned in the same way that Lucas, I'm sure, has revisioned a lot of his theories on how he worked. And, you know, we all do to a degree. So it's not a criticism, but it's just interesting that, you know, sometimes the purity of that early era or that Gene era, which is often used to combat against the more recent sort of Kurtzman era, in the same way that the Disney era is used against the Lucas era. These battlegrounds are drawn, which we don't really want to get into. I'm really interested, to be honest, in your feelings about that sort of 90s era, because my feeling was, I was very disappointed because maybe I was at an age where, to me, as I said, Star Trek wasn't about the utopia. It was about this exciting show with this exciting hero with these quirky, you know, partners, McCoy and Spock largely, defeating bad guys, I guess. And then you suddenly get like the first season of Star Trek Next Generation where you barely see a phaser used. It's all quite, and it's sort of mirroring the sort of almost like the safe space of the 80s, which was the soap drama. That was kind of where, you know, the longevity was. Yeah, if you could make things that were sort of broadly appealing, were quite dramatic, socially dramatic, rather than sort of science fiction dramatic, that was a kind of safe space to be in. You know, you didn't really push too many buttons. And that's where Star Trek, I know, and obviously it evolved and it became a lot better show after the first season, after the first two seasons especially.
Right.
But it still always felt to me that it was a very safe show. And as I was growing up, I was kind of frustrated with Star Trek in that era. I enjoyed Picard, I liked Data, but I felt it was very entrenched in a conservative, small C conservative ideology of network safety more than it, as much as reflecting its space, you know, its cultural space.
Well, you know, I went through an interesting journey with The Next Generation, and my wife would tell you I'm a contrarian. That's what Catherine would say. And maybe I am. When people were very down on The Next Generation and it was like starting in those first years, I was like vehemently supporting it. And then as it became popular, my support for it drifted off. and I think that has more to do with me. It's like I wanted more Star Trek. And when people were saying, well, I don't like Picard, I said, give him a chance. It's a different thing, you know, and I wanted to like it and support it. But I mean, there's no way around the obvious conclusion about the first couple seasons of The Next Generation. I mean, they have way too many episodes with, you know, Troy's mother or the holodeck. And, you know, I have a friend, Tony Mercer, who works on Enter the House Between with me, and you know, he calls those like the Love Boat in Space episodes, and that's what I call them too. I mean, there are no real stakes in most of those. You know, it's soap opera plotting. There's this whole idea of safety and security. You never really feel like the Enterprise is in danger in The Next Generation in those early years. Not in real danger. And you know, again, there and you know. It's the difference between in the 60s, Kirk and his crew saying, we're striving to be better, we're learning. All we need to say is we're not going to kill today. And that's Kirk's negotiation point with the Metrons or Anon 7, whatever, in Taste of Armageddon, right? It's like, we're striving, we're learning. Yes, we're savage, but my God, we're stepping out of the swamp of savagery. And by the time you get to The Next Generation, it's very different. It's like, aren't we special? Aren't we superior? Isn't our way the best? We are the best. And let us, you know, come to you and tell you how we're so much better than you. You know, there's an inherent philosophical difference between those two approaches. And, you know, I mean, I went back and I watched the original Star Trek this summer. I think I would have a much harder time going back and making it through those earlier seasons of The Next Generation. And I realize that's poison to some people's ears. And I get it because they have the same affection for The Next Generation.
Yeah.
It came in that time in their life. Yeah. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying there's a philosophical difference there to saying, you know, we have arrived at the pinnacle of civilization and here we are with our ship to bring our pinnacle of civilization to you. I mean, that's actually much more the kind of imperialism, gunboat diplomacy that the original Star Trek was accused of.
Yeah.
Right. The saying like, it's our way or the highway, bud. Right. We've mastered all that we've mastered poverty. We've mastered bigotry, all these things. And now we come to you to share this with you. What, you don't want it? Right. It's a very interesting dichotomy. I think, you know, Deep Space Nine was very clever to break that. And obviously some people did not like that, right? Some people really did. And now the trend in history is that people tend to like Deep Space Nine the best. But what it was clear from what the Berman era did in The Next Generation was that they created a universe that you know, there wasn't that sense of danger. There wasn't that sense of excitement. There wasn't that sense of the frontier. So what does Deep Space Nine do? It goes out to where there is a frontier, and you can get to the Gamma Quadrant, right? What does Voyager do? It says, we can't tell these stories here with the crew being perfect. Let's throw them out to the Delta Quadrant. What does Enterprise do? We have to go back 150 years. So again, we can have the kind of character conflict and adventure that we saw in the original series, because the Next Generation world, and again, my apologies to all those whose favors the Next Generation. I mean, absolutely entitled to that belief, and I'm sure they could argue it. But that's a much more antiseptic world.
Well, I would argue that even those later ones, which I totally agree with you, sort of push in other directions to find its edginess, to find its frontier.
Right.
But they are still caught in that conservative television trap that, you know, for all the groundbreaking elements of the 60s show, and you know, we can still look back and go, well, you know, having Uhura on the bridge, having a black lady on the bridge is a good representation. She still falls very much into a feeling of a receptionist in her role there, that she's not the number one from the pilot who was removed, because right. That was just, you know, audiences just weren't comfortable with that. But you know, you have these, there is some pushing there. I kind of felt, get to the 80s and all the way through, even in Deep Space Nine to a degree, and Voyager, there is a sort of safety there. There's no real massive cultural pushes. There's no queer representation at all. There is a couple of analogies to it in Deep Space right. Nine and Next Generation in terms of lesbian representation. But right. That, again, is still kind of weak and very... And there are a couple... There is that episode, isn't there, with the Riker, with the... androgynous
race. The outcast.
The outcast, right. Yeah, which does do some quiet, but again, you can feel it's struggling to know where to land that, because you can feel it's a show which does not have the support, either through the network or through the culture behind it, to really push any boundaries. And I must admit, early Star Trek Next Generation, it felt like the A arc and the B arcs were inversed. And the last episode, meeting the Romulans, becomes the B arc. It's barely in it. And the whole main arc is these three people, I think, from the past have been cryogenically unfrozen. And how do they cope with being in a new world? And that's the central arc, really, of the story. And then right. you cap it with the Romulans at the very end. And it's just like, I want to know about these Romulans. I don't want to know about these three.
you make a good point. I mean, that episode, The Neutral Zone, is by any other name a remake of Space Seed. And of course, Space Seed is the episode where they find Khan's people in suspended animation. They awake him. He is a huge challenge. They have to fight him. You know, they've opened Pandora's box literally by bringing him into the 23rd century and these views about eugenics and Earth and all this stuff. Now, fast forward, you know, 20 years, and it's the Neutral Zone. And what do? We wake up three yuppies and they want to know where their bank accounts are. I mean, it's like, okay, that's like, wow. Yeah. I mean, just in terms of, again, purely in terms of adventure and excitement, one is inherently filled with danger. And the other is taking place in a universe of safety. And I would argue at the time, because I did watch that, there was a visceral thrill when those Romulan warbirds decloaked for the first time. And you saw a ship not in, you know, it wasn't a mirror to the Enterprise in terms of its design, but like it was like, clearly this is a serious threat. And you know, they come back and they basically say, we are back, and that's your cliffhanger moment. It's like, That to me, yeah, that was the B plot, but to me it promised, okay, we are coming back. There is going to be danger next year. And then of course there wasn't really until they introduced the Borg. The Borg brought that danger into Star Trek The Next Generation, you know, in a very vivid way. And I mean, it's no surprise that episodes like Q Who, The Best of Both Worlds, where it's like the Federation is completely outmatched. And you know, we talk about being, you know, what is the word? Picard uses to Guinan at the end of Q Who, he says, maybe Q did the right thing for the wrong reasons. He says something along the lines of having kicked us out of our complacency. Okay, we're acknowledging it now. We have been cruising for a year and a half, right? In safe zones, in stories that don't have a real threat. And like suddenly the Borg now says, you know, they're coming and we're no longer in that safe place. And again,
that's the catalyst of the episode, isn't it? Is the whole thing, is their arrogance that
yes.
is where Q sends them, because they kind of like, yeah, as you said, almost like they just listen to this podcast, you know, we're on top of everything, you know, we've encountered everything we need to do to see, to know, to understand, and we are now at the right place and we can cope with anything. And it's like, well, no, you're not. I think we should say, because there's a lot of Star Trek Next Generation, which I you know, Measure of Man in season 2.
Oh, I love it.
It is a great story. There's loads of good stories in there. Best of Both Worlds.
Yep. And I love Conspiracy. There was a sense of danger in Conspiracy.
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh, you know, Starfleet's been infiltrated, you know, and you think Riker's been turned. It's like, oh wow, and the gore and the violence, like the last, like from Heart of Glory through Neutral Zone in the end of the first season, like, oh my god, they're nailing it now. They're finally getting it right at the end of this run. You know, I know a lot of people don't like Skin of Evil. I love Skin of Evil.
Skin of Evil's really good, yeah.
Yeah, I love that they killed Tasha Yar like that. Okay, Danger. Again, this is dangerous. You know, forget the holodeck, forget Loxana Troi. Space is dangerous. And those last several episodes, Heart of Glory, bringing the Klingons back in, and you know, when they escape from their cell and are loose on the Enterprise shooting crew members, oh my gosh, right? So you've got Heart of Glory, you've got Skin of Evil, you've got Conspiracy, and you've got that, you know, We Are Back with the Romulans. You know, it was clear there was some retuning going on. So like, we have to like raise the stakes on this a little bit, but then still, even that Neutral Zone episode, it's like most of it was, yeah, three yuppies in space, you know. We awoke not Khan, but you know, a Wall Street trader, you know, this is, yeah, not a great episode, but still hints that they understood that this has to be a little more serious and adventuresome and dangerous than what we've presented through most of this season. You know, if the Enterprise is always the big kid on the block, there's no danger, because the secret to drama is always to outmatch your heroes, right? Like, they should always have been coming up with something equal or greater than them and figuring out how do we negotiate that. But it was always, no, we're the best. We've arrived here to your backward planet. And, you know,
I kind of felt that Star Trek was coasting on not just the internal thing of them being that, like, the, you know, the human race was now at a point where it found its utopia, but almost as if the show itself was kind of comfortable in its arrogance that as sci-fi television went, it was the only kid on the block. And for me, when Babylon 5 appeared and seeing the intro to that, and it just blew me away. I think I saw a couple of the adverts for it. It's like, there's shooting in this, there's tension, there's war. We have, as this show went on, we have heroes who are not perfect, which was another problem I found with the Next Generation, was everyone was top of their class, rich, fulfilled people. There was no sense of anywhere for them to go, as you said, because they had become the utopia. They were just doing their day-to-day, ferrying people backwards and forth. There was just no feeling of where can these characters go? Where are their goals?
Right.
And then Babylon 5 came along, and that kind of, I think, sort of steered the DS9 movement. But yeah.
Well, even the setup of the Next Generation, the idea that we have families on the Enterprise, I mean, you know, speaks of this idea that, you know, we can't really go into danger, right?
Yeah.
you know, it's like, oh, okay. You know, if you have kids and families on the Enterprise, you're not going to be on the frontier, because, you know, how many times did Kirk's Enterprise, you know, barely skirt, you know, absolute destruction? I mean, do you want families faced up against the specter of a planet killer, or or Vol, or, you know, what have you? So I mean, the idea of sort of coasting in our safe zone is like practically encoded in the creation of the show. And I mean, the other thing I want to say too, and again, I know this is going to win me no fans, and I'm sorry, but the makeup of the Next Generation crew is very derivative. You know, Tasha, people know this, you can read it. Tasha was a response to Vasquez from the James Cameron film Alien. She was originally Macha Hernandez, right? She was going to be this, you know, tough security, you know. So Tasha is derivative there. Data, of course, comes straight from the Questor tapes and Zahn, but also Bishop from Aliens. And the dynamic, the, you know, what I call the Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice of space, it's, you know, you have the commanding officer in love with the doctor and the first officer in love with an exotic alien. Well, where did we see that before? Commander Koenig and Dr. Russell, Tony Verdeschi and Maya from Space 1999. I mean, the whole setup of The Next Generation is intensely derivative of things that had already happened, in sci-fi, sort of recent popular films, previous sci-fi TV series. I mean, it's kind of stunning, how derivative that setup is.
There's also a bit of a derivative in terms of the setup of those characters. So obviously sort of Geordi being the blind navigator, the irony of having the Klingon on board, who is in the first season, he's security, isn't he? He's still security, but he's just under Tasha. So you've got, your security guard being your enemy. You've got your anti-Spock, your Data, the Pinocchio, who's the android who wants to be human. There's a lot of sort of just reversals. And I do wonder, I'm not massively au fait with the history here, but I am aware that Roddenberry was very, very aggressively anti the sort of military tones that Nick Meyer sort of set up within Star Trek. Star Trek II that carried on. And I always wondered whether when Next Generation came on, there was almost like a sort of aggressive kickback or almost a need to bring Star Trek back to him rather than to where it was in the film franchise. And there was a lot of anti that was where Next Generation started. It would be peaceful. There wouldn't be the military feel to the show. There'd be families on board because that stops you making these naval ships.
I think that's a very good point. But, then what is Starfleet? And that's sort of the uneasy tension that I don't think it ever resolved. But I mean, I can understand Roddenberry wanting to go back to that vision of it being less military. But I mean, certainly the original Star Trek is hornblower in space. Maybe it got over-militarized in Wrath of Khan and Undiscovered Country. But that seems like a legitimate avenue to go down. If you're having ranks like captain and lieutenant, I don't know how, it's a military style hierarchy, right? I mean, yeah. I don't know how you quasi-military. I'm not sure how you get away from that. But, I may have told this story in a podcast before, so I hope the audience will forgive me if I have. And it may have been one of ours. But, the first night, a Encounter at Farpoint came on and I was really supporting it because I really wanted new Star Trek. I wanted these adventures and none of my friends the next day liked it. And, one of my best friend at that time, he said, "Why does everybody have superpowers?" It's like, Geordi can see better than anybody else. Data is super strong. Wesley is like a boy genius. Troy can read thought. It's like, you got the Klingon. It's like, I don't know. There is, and he said, even the costumes make them look like superheroes, which we don't think today, but think about going back to 1987 and first seeing those sort of costumes that look almost like Superman vests, if anybody's interested, that's sort of what like we were feeling in 1987,
Definitely.
A lot of people, I think about the show, but also, I mean, like, shockingly, the role of women didn't improve in The Next Generation. As late as the fourth season, Dr. Crusher and Troy were, breaking crockery over people's heads during fights, like it was the 1960s all over again. And, and that I think you really have to give Deep Space Nine credit for. Both Dax and Kira, fully formed, capable people in roles of great authority, nuanced characters with flaws and foibles. And, I do think that was a great, changing point for Star Trek. Somebody said, okay, enough of the breaking crockery, folks. Let's have the women be heroic. Let's let them pilot the ships. Let's let them command the station. Let's put them in the roles we know women can play, right? And I mean, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a character more morally nuanced, more interesting, more adventurous than what Kira Nerys was, or is. And I mean, I also feel that way about Janeway, of course, in Voyager. But, so Star Trek did get there. But let's be honest, it didn't get there in the Next Generation.
Well, I wonder how much, and again, I don't know, and I'm sure anyone listening to this can inform me otherwise, how much Ron Moore was part of that. I mean, Ensign Ro, which, as you know, was the initially meant to be the Kira character in Deep Space Nine, before the actress turned that down, is obviously, we see in those later Star Trek Next Generations, a little more of a push towards sort of better female representation. But yeah, you're right. You don't really get that until Deep Space Nine and to some degree Voyager. But again, it all still feels quite safe and everything in it feels safe. You know, again, Voyager suffers because they're in a Delta Quadrant, which feels exactly the same as the Alpha Quadrant. You know, this, and the ship never, apart from its year of hell, which it then retcons, it just is fine pretty much all the way through, self-sufficient, largely. There are some episodes which is built around that problem of sustainability, but the show never really, under that era, until Enterprise ends, it feels very safe. And the films, to a degree in that era, feel very safe as well.
Absolutely. I say Insurrection.
Yeah. I like Insurrection in itself, but it is a TV episode. It is a Next Generation feature-length TV episode. It's there's no groundbreakingness there. There's no feeling of this being the leading American sci-fi franchise. You don't feel that it's pushing itself anymore, which is and as you say, there's a lot of derivative stuff. I mean, how many times, even now, has Star Trek II been remade within Star Trek?
Well, I mean, again, now people are going to start sending, you know, arrows at me, but, you know, just to watch everybody fall in love with, you know, Picard season three. And again, the best it can do is sort of be a shallow copy of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. We have a villain who wants revenge. We have a captain who has fathered a son out of wedlock and is estranged from them. It really shows sort of, I think, the inherent biases of Star Trek fans. You know, so many Star Trek fans hate Star Trek Into Darkness. Okay, what is their complaint? It's Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan all over again. They're doing the same thing all over again. Then Picard III comes along, does the same thing all over again. I love it.
I mean, to be fair, I mean, Into Darkness was very on its nose the way it tried to take some of the core emotional values of Star Trek II without really using setting them up so they work. So the reversal at the end of Star Trek Into Darkness has none of the rhythm, power, and just the sort of the cadence which is in Star Trek II. But then, like you said, I don't think the Picard manages it perfectly. I suppose the difference with Picard is that it is a homage. I mean, they'd say it's a homage. They'd make it so blatant that it's Star Trek II. The fonts, the sounds on the bridge, they take from every element of Star Trek II is in there. Even the design of the to become Enterprise is around that motion picture era.
But it doesn't really make sense in the 25th century that would be the case. We're going to go back to building starships like they were two centuries ago. Seeing how often Star Trek II has been redone, and let's face it, Nemesis was Star Trek II redone, right?
Yeah.
Insurrection to a degree was. It's like, I love Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. I don't ever need to see it again. Right? Yeah. I don't ever need to see it redone again. Right? You know, it seems to me the one that they should be struggling to redo and find new ways to do should either be Star Trek The Motion Picture or Star Trek The Voyage Home. something that has more of those core Star Trek values like exploration and contacting something new and different and negotiating that new indifference and the fear that comes from that new indifference and then the understanding and transcendence comes from that new and different thing, right? That is the Star Trek paradigm. Like, you know, I know people used to say this about when Return of the Jedi was called Revenge of the Jedi, they'd say, well, Revenge isn't the Way of the Jedi. Why are you calling it that movie? Well, George Lucas had the wisdom to change it to Return of the Jedi. You know, revenge being the motivating factor of so many Star Trek stories, that's a huge compromise to Star Trek philosophy. Like, I don't need any more wrath. I don't need any more villains coming back at Heroes after 15 years because they want revenge. Like, it was great in a one-off in the Wrath of Khan, but like for that to be the galvanizing force of all of these Star Trek stories, that's so disappointing.
I think, I suppose, also with Star Trek too, and I know I tried to steer us away from going into the movies, but I don't think we can.
I'm sorry.
because it's so integral to the legacy of where it went, is that they seem to lose or miss where Star Trek II works. And to be fair, Picard Season 3 kind of spots it. Whether it manages it to do it with such style, I don't think it quite manages at the end. But it is, as you say, it's about age, it's about estrangement, it's about finding your youth again when you right. feel that you are. And that those sorts of parallels which work, again, in different ways for Khan as well as Kirk. And what, you know, Spock as well, it's a very clever, fantastic movie in the way it intertwines all these with almost perfect rhythm, with a perfect ending, which, you know, again, some of it is just down to serendipity of talents coming together and doing it in a way that just works. And if you're going to borrow from any place from Star Trek, don't borrow from the top, because you've got nowhere else to go. You borrow from Star Trek V and make yours better, or you borrow from Nemesis and make it better. Well, Nemesis is, as you say, is basically Wrath of Khan as well.
But, right, you know, right, yeah.
That's some of the mistakes being made there. And again, a bit with the Pi movies. I just want to quickly touch on the Pi movies, because I think they are themselves an interesting introspection into Star Trek. And when I first saw them, I really didn't like them. I've rewatched them since and I've enjoyed them more. I've enjoyed Pine's performance. I think Zachary Quinto is great. Carl Urban is fantastic at doing DeForest Kelly without looking like he's actually just trying to mimic DeForest Kelly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good stuff going in there, and sort of interesting acknowledgement of the vibrancy of the old Star Trek, which it revitalizes with confidence.
Right.
Talk to me a little bit about your feelings on the Pine universe.
Well, I, to the chagrin of many of my friends, I really like those films. You know, I know I have some friends who say, you know, they are aggressively stupid. They don't have the philosophy and sort of internal consistency of the original series and the franchise through, you know, Enterprise. And I am sensitive to those arguments. I do know sort of where I was circa 2002 to 2005. And that was the Enterprise Nemesis era. You know, this is where, you know, Nemesis, a pale, deadly regurgitation of Wrath of Khan. And then you have Enterprise with Captain Archer going to Aurora Pente first and doing everything Kirk does 100 years later.
Yes.
And the Klingons having a vendetta against him. You know, there'll be no peace as long as Archer lives, basically. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, we are stuck in a sort of replicative fading mode where Star Trek is fading out. And this upset me because it was in this era in 2006 that my son was born. And I thought really of the role Star Trek had played, continues to play in my life. It inspires, it excites, you know, it's got all these great things that we've talked about. And so in that era, Star Trek felt talky, it felt old, it felt repetitive, safe, insular.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of people don't like J.J. Abrams. They don't like his lens flare. They don't like his approach that is, you know, somewhat generic to the material. He said it himself. He didn't really understand Star Trek. But what does he do? He makes Star Trek young again.
Yeah.
He makes Star Trek colorful again. He makes Star Trek fast and exciting and unexpected again. And I was there for that. I honestly was. Those were the things I thought, because you know what? In a world where Star Trek is competing for attention with Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings movies and all these things, and the Star Wars movies are back, you know, having a long discussion in the Ready Room, you know, that's deadly dull about some esoteric concept that we've talked about before in Star Trek, that is not going to bring in the next generation of Star Trek fans. What will bring them in is it being colorful, vibrant, exciting. Now, do I wish some of those movies operated on the premise of a little more intention and a little more intelligence and a little more fidelity to Star Trek? Yes, of course I do. Of course I do. But it has those virtues. It's fast. It's funny. It's heartfelt. It's exciting. It's colorful. A lot of those things that Star Trek once was, it was again in those what people deride as new Trek movies. I mean, that's my honest and true. I think the cast is great. I don't think, like, I really like Beyond. I would love to see them get their shot at a really great Star Trek premise. I really think they could do it. I think they have a great Star Trek movie in them. And Chris Pine knows this. He said, like, Star Trek should not be in search of the billion-dollar Marvel movie. I totally agree. Get a great concept with this fantastic cast, a great science fiction, great Star Trek concept, but make it smaller. You can still make it immediate. We don't need all that Marvel shit, pardon my French, and Star Trek. You know, to tell a contained smart story about characters and give us that great Kelvin Star Trek movie. It's out there. The cast is great. The production values great. So, I mean, I enjoy them, but I understand why people don't like them or see them as a violation. And you know, fortunately, we can just say, well, it's an alternate universe. You know, to me, that's the saving grace. Because, listen, do I have trouble with the fact that they blew up Vulcan? Yeah, I do. I really do. That really bothers me, given the importance of Vulcan and Star Trek. But if you say this is an alternate universe, goes a different way, does not affect our universe, I guess I'm okay with it.
And you're right, it doesn't have to be like Disney. I mean, isn't that what Wrath of Khan showed? That you could do a very lean budget Star Trek film where you're effectively using the same bridge set for 70% of your film.
Right, exactly.
You're cutting bits out of motion picture in terms of footage you're reusing of the Enterprise as well to help, and reusing models, turning them upside down. And you can do all this, you know, if you have confidence in it. And I kind of felt the problem with Star Trek ever since the 80s, and it was still even slightly visible with the Pine era, is there's a sort of kind of lack of confidence to let it just be itself and do its own thing. And as you say, by the time of season four of Enterprise, with Manny involved and everyone celebrating how he sort of brought it up a notch, but ultimately all he was doing was taking all the good bits, as you said, the previous stuff, and making it Enterprises. And fans enjoyed that, but ultimately it wasn't doing anything new. And again, I'd love to really underscore that I have a lot of love for all these eras. I think
me too.
That sort of 90s era is an era which, as always happens as we get further away from it, becomes idealized, and especially in relation to current Trek. It's kind of now seen as almost the perfection, and I'd say it really wasn't. And it was not at all, and it was not doing what it really should have been doing. And especially when you saw, as I say, these younglings coming up like Babylon 5, Farscape, Lex, before the hit of 9/11, which, as you say, changed television generally in what they would do. Bar Battlestar Galactica, perhaps, as the outlier. But, you know, they were doing fresh things. We were getting away from technobabble. We were getting away from the need of hierarchies, and, you know, we were getting back. Farscape very much is the core essence of the adventure again. We're going back to the 60s, 70s.
Yes. I love Farscape. Oh, my gosh. And, you know, and Firefly, too, even though
Firefly, it's Firefly, yeah, later on, yeah. Firefly, yeah, totally. Right. And, well, you don't need to explain everything, and that's fine, you know. Only Spock needs to know what the tachyon particle emissions are of this thing. When he asks, Kirk doesn't care. He just wants to know, is it an energy we can deal with, or can we not deal with? Can we identify it, or can we not?
Part 2 will be coming soon.